Chapter 37. Every morning and night he was the same, and thus New Year's Eve broke the wedding day. The lovers did not rise at milking time, having through the whole of this last week of their sojourn at the dairy, been accorded something of the position of guests, Tess being honored with a room of her own. When they arrived downstairs at breakfast time, they were surprised to see what effects had been produced in the large kitchen for their glory, since they had last beheld it. At some unnatural hour of the morning, the dairyman had caused the yawning chimney corner to be whitened, and the brick hearth reddened, and a blazing yellow damask blower to be hung across the arch in place of the old grimy blue cotton one with a black sprig pattern which had formerly done duty there. This renovated aspect of what was the focus indeed of the room on a full winter morning, threw a smiling demeanor over the whole apartment. I was determined to do some at in honor of, said the dairyman. And as he wouldn't hear of my guying a rattling good randy why fiddles and bass viols complete, as we should have done in old times, this was all I could think go as a noiseless thing. Tess's friends lived so far off that none could conveniently have been present at the ceremony, even had any been asked. But as a fact nobody was invited from Marlott. As for Angel's family, he had written and duly informed them of the time, and assured them that he would be glad to see one at least of them there for the day, if he would like to come. His brothers had not replied at all, seeming to be indignant with him, while his father and mother had written a rather sad letter, deploring his precipitancy in rushing into marriage, but making the best of the matter by saying that, though a dairywoman was the last daughter-in-law they could have expected, their son had arrived at an age which he might be supposed to be the best judge. This coolness in his relations distressed Claire less than it would have done, had he been without the grand card with which he meant to surprise them ere long. To produce Tess, fresh from the dairy, as a d'Urberville and a lady, he had felt to be temerarious and risky. Hence he had concealed her lineage till such time as, familiarized with worldly ways by a few months' travel and reading with him, he could take her on a visit to his parents, and impart the knowledge, while triumphantly producing her as worthy of such an ancient line. It was a pretty lover's dream, if no more. Perhaps Tess's lineage had more value for himself than for anybody in the world beside. Her perception that Angel's bearing towards her still remained in no whit altered by her own communication rendered Tess guiltily doubtful if he could have received it. She rose from breakfast before he had finished and hastened upstairs. It had occurred to her to look once more into the queer gaunt room which had been Claire's den, or rather eyrie, for so long, and climbing the ladder she stood at the open door of the apartment, regarding and pondering. She stooped to the threshold of the doorway, whereas he had pushed in the note 2 or 3 days earlier in such excitement. The carpet reached close to the sill, and under the edge of the carpet she discerned the faint white margin of the envelope containing her letter to him, which he obviously had never seen, owing to her having in her haste thrust it beneath the carpet as well as beneath the door. With a feeling of faintness she withdrew the letter. There it was sealed up, just as it had left her hands. The mountain had not yet been removed. She could not let him read it now, the house being in full bustle of preparation, and descending to her own room she destroyed the letter there. She was so pale, when he saw her again, that he felt quite anxious. The incident of the misplaced letter as he had jumped at, as if it prevented a confession, but she knew in her conscience, that it need not. There was still time. Yet everything was in a stir. There was coming and going. All had to dress, the dairyman and Mrs. Crick having been asked to accompany them as witnesses, and reflection or deliberate talk was well nigh impossible. The only minute Tess could get to be alone with Claire was when they met upon the landing. I am so anxious to talk to you, I want to confess all my faults and blunders, she said with attempted lightness. No, we can't have faults talked of. You must be deemed perfect today at least, my sweet, he cried. We shall have plenty of time, hereafter, I hope, to talk over our failings. I will confess mine at the same time. but it would be better for me to do it now, I think, so that you could not say, well, my quixotic one, you shall tell me anything, say, as soon as we are settled in our lodging, not now. I, too, will tell you my faults then. But do not let us spoil the day with them, they will be excellent matter for a dull time. Then you don't wish me to, dearest? I do not, Tessie, really. The hurry of dressing and starting left no time for more than this. Those words of his seemed to reassure her on further reflection. She was whirled onward through the next couple of critical hours by the mastering tide of her devotion to him, which closed up further meditation. Her one desire, so long resisted, to make herself his, to call him her lord, her own then, if necessary, to die had at last lifted her up from her plodding reflective pathway. Undressing, she moved about in a mental cloud of many-colored idealities, which eclipsed all sinister contingencies by its brightness. The church was a long way off, and they were obliged to drive, particularly as it was winter. A close carriage was ordered from a roadside inn, a vehicle which had been kept there ever since the old days of post-chaise traveling. It had stout wheel spokes, and heavy fellows, a great curved bed, immense straps and springs, and a pole like a battering ram. The postillion was a venerable boy of 60, a martyr to rheumatic gout, the result of excessive exposure in youth, counteracted by strong liquors, who had stood at indoors doing nothing for the whole 25 years that had elapsed since he had no longer been required to ride professionally, as if expecting the old times to come back again. He had a permanent running wound on the outside of his right leg, originated by the constant bruisings of aristocratic carriage poles during the many years that he had been in regular employ at the King's Arms, Casterbridge. Inside this cumbrous and creaking structure, and behind this decayed conductor, the party car retook their seats, the bride and bridegroom and Mr. and Mrs. Crick. Angel would have liked one at least of his brothers to be present as groomsmen, but their silence after his gentle hint to that effect by letter had signified that they did not care to come. They disapproved of the marriage, and could not be expected to countenance it. Perhaps it was as well that they could not be present. They were not worldly young fellows, but fraternizing with dairy folk would have struck unpleasantly upon their biased niceness, apart from their view of the match. Upheld by the momentum of the time, Tess knew nothing of this, did not see anything, did not know the road they were taking to the church. She knew that Angel was close to her, all the rest was a luminous mist. She was a sort of celestial person, who owed her being to poetry one of those classical divinities Claire was accustomed to talk to her about when they took their walk together. The marriage being by license, there were only a dozen or so of people in the church. Had there been 1,000, they would have produced no more effect upon her. They were at stellar distances from her present world. In the ecstatic solemnity with which she swore her faith to him, the ordinary sensibilities of sex seemed a flippancy. At a pause in the service, while they were kneeling together, she unconsciously inclined herself towards him, so that her shoulder touched his arm, as he had been frightened by a passing thought, and the movement had been automatic, to assure herself that he was really there, and to fortify her belief that his fidelity would be proof against all things. Claire knew that she loved him, every curve of her form showed that, but he did not know at that time the full depth of her devotion, its single-mindedness, its meekness, what long-suffering it guaranteed, what honesty, what endurance, what good faith. As they came out of church, the ringers swung the bells off their rests, and a modest peal of 3 notes broke forth, that limited amount of expression having been deemed sufficient by the church builders for the joys of such a small parish. Passing by the tower with her husband on the path to the gate, she could feel the vibrant air humming round them from the loud belfry in the circle of sound, and it matched the highly charged mental atmosphere in which she was living. This condition of mind, wherein she felt glorified by an irradiation not her own, like the angel whom St. John saw in the sun, lasted till the sound of the church bells had died away, and the emotions of the wedding service had calmed down. Her eyes could dwell upon details more clearly now, and Mr. and Mrs. Crick, having directed their own gig to be sent for them, to leave the carriage to the young couple, she observed the build and character of that conveyance for the first time. Sitting in silence, she regarded it long. "I fancy you seem oppressed, Tessie," said Claire. "Yes," she answered, putting her hand to her brow. "I tremble at many things. It is all so serious, Angel. Among other things, I seem to have seen this carriage before, to very well acquainted with it. It is very odd, I must have seen it in a dream. Oh, you have heard the legend of the D'Urberville coach, that well-known superstition of this county about your family, when they were very popular here, and this lumbering old thing reminds you of it." "I have never heard of it to my knowledge," said she. "What is the legend, may I know it?" "Well, I would rather not tell it in detail just now. A certain D'Urberville of the 16th or 17th century committed a dreadful crime in his family coach, and since that time members of the family see or hear the old coach whenever, but I'll tell you another day, it is rather gloomy. Evidently some dim knowledge of it has been brought back to your mind by the sight of this venerable caravan." "I don't remember hearing it before," she murmured. "Is it when we are going to die, Angel, that members of my family see it, or is it when we have committed a crime? Now, Tess." He silenced her by a kiss. By the time they reached home, she was contrite and spiritless. She was Mrs. Angel Clare, indeed, but had she any moral right to the name? Was she not more truly Mrs. Alexander D'Urberville? Could intensity of love justify what might be considered in upright souls as culpable reticence? She knew not what was expected of women in such cases, and as he had no counselor. However, when she found herself alone in her room for a few minutes the last day this on which she was ever to enter it, she knelt down and prayed. She tried to pray to God, but it was her husband who really had her supplication. Her idolatry of this man was such that she herself almost feared it to be ill-omened. She was conscious of the notion expressed by Friar Lawrence. These violent delights have violent ends. It might be too desperate for human conditions, too rank, too wild, too deadly. "Oh, my love, why do I love you so?" she whispered there alone. "For she you love is not my real self, but one in my image, the one I might have been." Afternoon came, and with it the hour for departure. They had decided to fulfill the plan of going for a few days to the lodgings, in the old farmhouse near Wellbridge Mill, at which he meant to reside during his investigation of flower processes. At 2 o'clock there was nothing left to do but to start. All the servantry of the dairy were standing in the red brick entry, to see them go out, the dairyman and his wife following to the door. Tess saw her three chambermaids in a row against the wall, pensively inclining their heads. She had much questioned if they would appear at the parting moment, but there they were, stoical and staunch to the last. She knew why the delicate Reddy looked too fragile, and is so tragically sorrowful, and Marion so blank, and she forgot her own dogging shadow for a moment in contemplating theirs. She impulsively whispered to him, "Will you kiss them all, once, poor things, for the first and last time?" Claire had not the least objection to such a farewell formality, which was all that it was to him, and as he passed them, he kissed them in succession where they stood, saying goodbye to each as he did so. When they reached the door, Tess femininely glanced back to discern the effect of that kiss of charity. There was no triumph in her glance, as there might have been. If there had, it would have disappeared, when she saw how moved the girls all were. The kiss had obviously done. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.